Hey folks, Sam Jones here. And before we get started with our 154th edition of Off Camera, I just want to ask you to take a minute, go to iTunes if you have not subscribed to this show yet, subscribe to Off Camera with Sam Jones, and give us a rating and a review. The more positive ratings and reviews we get, the more the secret evil algorithms will share and spread Off Camera. So let's all hail to the robots and feed them some five-star ratings so that we can spread the word about this show. It only takes a minute, and it's a great way to support the show. All right, let's get on to the main event. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Rose Byrne. Even with all of her success, Rose Byrne still spent years of her career wailing and breaking down in audition rooms. As she says, and I quote, "Women often have to start with a breakdown scene in auditions. Do guys have to do this? No. It's such a cliche, but it's always crying or she's got her top off. The classic hits of auditioning when you were a woman." Well, luckily, Rose hasn't been limited to those classic hits. Her breakout performance in America came opposite Glenn Close in FX's thrilling legal drama series, Damages, a show that was ahead of its time with two strong female protagonists. Since then, she's flourished in big-budget comedies like the female-centric films Bridesmaids and Spy. And she's shown off her rowdy Aussie side, as opposed to the stereotypical woman as buzzkill in comedy side, in Neighbors, opposite Seth Rogen. Her most recent film is Juliet Naked, based on the Nick Hornby novel of the same name. Shooting a small film in a quiet seaside village in England is a change from big-budget comedies, but the experience is quite familiar to Rose, bringing her back to her indie Australian roots. Reflecting back on where she's come from is a theme for Rose, especially when she's struggling to maintain a thick skin after rejection or when the harsh self-critic is a little too loud in her head. After taking some advice from a friend, Rose agrees, "You have to look back and look how far you've come, because it's the only way you can give yourself a break." Indeed. Rose joins Off Camera to discuss her extreme fear of public speaking, how following her intuition serves her well as an actress, and how potato chips can ruin an otherwise perfectly good performance. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Rose.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, I've been a fan for a long time, and I discovered you sort of accidentally on Damages, and I was immediately hooked on that show, and since then have seen so many things. And this new film you have, Juliet Naked, is from a book that I really loved. I'm a Nick Hornby fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you, but I'm always a little cynical when I see that they've made a movie out of a book that I like. I always wonder, can it match the movie in my head?
Can it live up to it, yeah.
And we should say it's about, there's a reclusive musician, and you are in a long-term relationship with his world, his biggest fan, who's obsessed about him, and he's disappeared for years, and nobody knows where he is. And through the course of this movie, this musician affects both your lives in a very profound way, and it takes place in a small, around Brighton in
England?
Yeah,
it's a small sort of anonymous village, seaside village town in the UK.
Right.
Slightly grim, slightly pretty, sort of.
Right, grim when it rains,
yeah,
pretty when
exactly, the classic sort of British seaside towns. And yeah, in the novel, yeah, then the musician Tucker Crowe sort of ends up changing our life. But yeah, I had read the book too when it came out and just loved it. Loved it. I was a Nick Hornby fan, but that was my favourite novel by far. Like, I loved the Annie, the protagonist, was so empathic and funny, and it's got all the sort of Nick Hornby quintessential themes of, like,
yes,
music nerds, music obsessives, not growing up, a hijacked kind of youth, and, you know, these guys that don't grow up, and passion for music and love for music, and how much he's sort of, that's his obsession, which is his sort of one of his signature things.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so I heard about it very early on and I was like, oh, that's so cool. I would love to read that script. I would love to be a part of it. Would they consider me? And I was really excited. I was like, you know, when a book really affects you and you've just enjoyed the story so much. I was like, what an experience to be. I've never done that before. Like,
oh, really?
No. So I met early on with Jesse Peretz, who was working on one of the adaptations and was set to direct. And he himself has a great musical background. He was one of the founding members of the Lemonheads in the early 90s, and like he has directed a lot of music videos, and so he's very much from that world. And I think Judd is great at matching, you know, directors with projects.
Well, that's the balancing act of this film, because I think that there are a few leaps of faith that the audience has to make because the circumstances are pretty incredible that this person would come out of hiding and start speaking to a woman in this tiny little town and she happens to be the girlfriend of the most obsessive fan.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
if you don't get those music nerd details right, then you can't enter the world. I think in this film, it shows that a musician made it and a musician produced it.
Oh, good.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I do. I think if you don't believe that, if you don't take that leap of faith, as you put it so well, then you're not going to commit to the story and you're not going to believe anything. And it does take someone who understands that obsessive, weird, strange quality that people have. It's like fanboys, but it's about music,
right.
Not about comic books, you know, it's that sort of obsessive quality that they have.
So when you get involved, do you go back and read the book again? Or does it become just the script? Or?
Yeah, I did. It's so personal for each actor or artist with the process, but I've definitely revisited the novel a lot because it's so much in Annie's narrative, a lot of it. So I just, for me, it was really helpful. It was like a warm kind of blanket to put on and remind myself of exactly who I was and what I was doing and what she was doing and all those sorts of things. So it was, for me, I liked that. And I think when you are working from a book, whether it's a novel or an autobiography or whatever it may be, where you have to sort of jump off from that and leave it behind and just be in the moment of what you're doing and create the film or the TV show or whatever it may be and let go of the novel. Because it is never going to be the same. It's never going to be as good as it is when you are reading it.
But was it like having more source material to go to, like when there's a scene about Annie and you can think about the book and you know, like, because obviously in the book there's more information.
Yes, yeah. But totally, like I would... There was a scene that was challenging. I'd always run back to the book and be thumbing through the pages on set and trying to, like, read the narrative of what's going on in her head, so it would just kind of help me set the scene.
Oh, really?
What was happening. I would sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, because I think that would be a great resource to be able to...
Exactly. It is a great resource, particularly for an actress, an actor. For me, it really helped. But, you know, I have to let that go in a way. But it's like a lot of... even with, you know, these comic book films, those fans are so rabid. I'm sure there is pressure to bring them to life in a way that people will love them as much as they love the characters from the comics or the cartoons or whatever.
Right.
It is a lot of pressure. Like, I know, like you said, when you see a great novel that you've enjoyed being made into a film, you're always like, is this going to be...
Do those people know these characters as well
exactly.
as I do?
They cannot possibly
understand them.
Exactly. Like they're not going to get it. They're not going to get it. So.
Yeah. And we've all seen the bad version of our favorite book.
I know, we have. And it's rare that it transcends it, isn't it? Like, I remember reading Trainspotting after the film. And I found it's a tough read. It's like, it's written in the vernacular with the accent. It's quite, like, it's tough. And I guess I found the film a lot more accessible in a way. I was like, it was interesting. For me, it was a little bit of a reverse experience.
I wonder if it's whichever one you get to first that
becomes
your...
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's such a good point. I think it probably is what gets to you first, right?
Yeah, because then those images are set. The Trainspotting images are set for you.
Yeah.
You can't divorce those memories in your head from
mm-hmm.
them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's really true.
As I was watching this film, I couldn't help but think that this is a bit of an endangered species, like this smaller budget film about adults that isn't filled with special effects or this crazy thriller premise or something. And it's about real things. It's a naturalistic film, and you get to make it on location with a smaller crew.
Mm.
Like, is that, after doing, you've done some really big films, is that a different experience to go and make a handmade
It is
project?
A dying breed. I totally think it's an endangered species.
It is, right?
It's sort of something you would see on television now.
Yeah.
Like, drama is really on television. It's not in the theatres. Like, the theatres is like robots and, you know, maybe like a huge comedy and that's it, like it, or a horror film or something, but it's very genre. It's a small film. It's a film that you would have seen in the 90s, not something that you would see now. It's like a relationship movie. It's a relationship drama comedy.
It doesn't fit into a genre. It is sort of that.
It's Nick Hornby, really, is the
right.
genre. Like, he's so specific with his tone as a reader or viewer, I think you immediately have a concept of how the tone of it. But it's totally an endangered species. And also to find an audience. I mean, you want the film to be seen, obviously, you know, yeah. So it's like finding that audience. And it's such a crowded place now of things to watch and see, the internet, online, all these platforms, and which is incredible, but so many things get lost, you know? So it's about, like, trying to reach an audience and have respect for what they want to watch and all that sort of stuff. So.
Was it a different experience for you as an actor in terms of just the day-to-day making a film of that size?
I mean, I'm from Australia, so the films I grew up doing are all like that. They were all shot in the same amount of time for the same sort of budget with just people chatting, and it was all like little indie filmmaking the whole time in Australia, so that's what I right. grew up doing. So for me, it felt pretty familiar. And we were shooting in England, you know, it's like England and Australia are it's all pretty familiar.
It felt like a step backward. You're like, uh-oh.
Yeah, you know, so... So it was at the same time familiar, but also like a pleasure. Like, wow, I got to do this character from a novel that I love, from an author who I respect, with this great director who I also respect and admire, and these great actors. So I felt really lucky. I was like, man, I'm lucky this movie's getting made.
Yeah.
And that I'm in it.
And there's probably different concerns right at the end of a scene in terms of what to focus in on.
Yeah.
Right? Rather than. Yeah. Will this play to totally. 4,000 screens?
Yeah, or, you know, I'd just done, like, Peter Rabbit, which is, like, a fake animated thing, and you're talking to, like, a blue guy or, like, nothing, you know,
right.
talking to the rabbit, blah, 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 and, like, compared to acting with this real person with a script, with a, you know, which was, so that was, yeah, it was a pleasure in that sense.
That is funny when you mention that, because those are two totally different jobs,
yeah.
right? It's not something you could ever imagine probably when you're learning your craft, that you're going to end up talking to a fake rabbit and there's not a script.
You're just improvising a lot. So, you know, and I had been doing a lot of those films which are more improv comedy, and this was a little more scripted. And so it is, yeah, it is a different, each job requires different elements of your sort of abilities in a way.
Right. Well, I want to ask you about a scene. It's a small little scene. There's no dialogue. You're just driving in a car,
mm-hmm.
and you're despondent. You're crying and you're sad, and it's a very relatable scene for anyone who's ever been an adult, because we've all driven a car and cried. It's sort of,
haven't we all?
But I would think you'd probably have to draw on a lot more of real things to get there, unlike maybe the crying you did in Bridesmaids. and I guess just
also in a car.
Yeah, but I guess I'm curious as just a viewer of what it took to do that for you, or what you were thinking to transfer it to me as an audience member and go, oh, I recognize that. That's real. That's not.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I know. As a viewer, I'm always love those moments where you're just swept up in the performance of someone, whether they're in some kind of emotional turmoil or whatever, and you go, oh, I relate to that, and it's such a kind of, you know, I'm a very interactive member of an audience, you know, like,
yeah.
Annie's such a tough character because she just plays her cards so close to her chest, and she's so British and sort of like reserved and very, like, she's been in this relationship for so long with this guy, and just like has just sort of like shut her down so much. So it was important for the narrative to just get that beat right, because I felt that, you know, that sense of when someone's like finally kind of breaking out of their shell a bit.
Absolutely,
you know, and
that, yeah.
There's so many risks she's sort of taking, and then it sort of all culminates in this one of these moments. So it was like an important beat to hit, and I was glad it made it in the film. I wasn't even sure because she's very sort of stoic as a character in a way. So,
right.
Yeah.
So is that you crying as her there, or is that you drawing on one of your own memories to get there?
That was pretty straightforward, because we had just done, in terms of like Ethan and I had just done a scene, so it was like sort of carrying on from that in a way, and like thinking like the loss of she would have been having and stuff like that. But it's always pretty ephemeral too. Like, I'm never sure how it's going to unfold in the scene, and there's pressure in those scenes in a way, because it's like it's a result that you have to get to, which I don't love. Like, I don't love this idea of like a result. You just want to see what happens.
Right.
In a way.
If the scene is basically the subtext is
written,
this
yeah.
is an emotional beat you have to hit, that feels like pressure, you're saying.
A little bit, yeah. It's like it's a result-based performance, whereas like it's more exciting if you can sort of hand the car keys over to, like, as an actor, you know, if you just hand the car keys over to something else in the scene and just let it happen, so you just sort of are out, lose control a little bit instead of being so microscopic about things. But it's, again, it's such a technical thing too with filmmaking, so I'm more just aware of it now, of like, how long do we have, blah, 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 just trying to, like, break it down like that, because it is, it's such a moving parts, and there's so many moving parts to a movie, and making, you know, timing, and this person's got to hand you that while you do it, go over there, and, like, it's such a dance of everybody creating this thing together. So,
and you're sort of at that moment when they're all setting up the shot and everything, you're sort of in a bubble, I would assume, as an actor.
And in a way, that's sort of an easy part, the scene, in a way, because I am in this sheltered little bubble, and so I can just, you know, take off from the last scene and try to take it off from there. But it's a, when it's a more hectic scene, then it's a little harder.
Right.
You know, it can be.
So take me through that. So you know you're about to get in the car, they've got it lit, and you know you have to cry.
Mm.
Is it almost like you shouldn't think about it too much?
A little bit, I reckon. It's such a personal thing for each actress and actor. Like,
do you just trust it'll happen when the time comes?
The best I can, but I'm, you know, it's, again, it's like an ephemeral thing. Like, sometimes I feel like I'm, you know, I don't want to, like, be, like, thinking about my dog that died or not. You know, I don't want to. I would rather be sort of trying to carry on from what we've done and all the work we've done and throwing it out the window and honouring this moment, because it's, like, an important moment for the character.
Yeah.
But I think at that point we were into the shoot, had found my feet with the role, you know, so it was sort of, it was good. It's harder if it's at the beginning, you know, if it's like first day of the shoot and you've got to, like, do some really emotional scene. And, and you know, often with, like, female characters, like, particularly, like, in auditions, it's always like, she breaks down in, like, the first,
and that's,
you know,
the scene they pick for the audition. Right.
And it's like, oh, my God, do the guys have to do this? No. You know, it's always like, you got to, like, you know, it's always crying, or she's got her top off, or, like, you know, it's like the, like, the classic hits of what the female character's doing. But that's what I loved about Annie, was that she was really tough and she didn't really cry. She doesn't really cry in this film. She's like, that's the kind of one of the defining things about her, is that she's, like, a very emotionally restrained person, and, like, she sort of comes out in different ways, and this whole thing is about her being a rebellious and breaking out and breaking up with her boyfriend, seeing this crazy guy and choosing whether she'll have a child or not by herself. Like, so that moment where she does actually get emotional was, like, really important, because
it's
not like she's just a mess the whole time, you know. And I love that about her because of all my auditioning, right?
Yeah.
I had to, like, break down half the time.
But that's interesting. I've never thought of that before, where in an audition, those are the scenes that are picked for you to do.
Always. They're always those scenes. Yeah, there's, like, oh, God. Yeah, I will just, years of auditioning and having to, like, you know, break down in the middle of a scene or at the start, or, like, screaming or whatever the thing may be, or, you know, they're dead on the floor, you're crying. You know, they sort of, like, you know, and thanks very much. And then you're back in your car, back on, like, La Brea, going, wow, what just happened? And then they make you learn, you know, 30 pages of dialogue, and then you get there and they go, we're just going to do the first scene, so it's just the first two pages. And you've meanwhile been, like, slaving for 5 days, learning it, acting coach, voice coach, like, doing all your prep work, and then you get in and they're like, it's just the first two pages.
It's that first scene when she's in her bikini.
Yeah, just the one in the bikini when you're making out.
Yeah.
You don't have to make out. You can just take your top off.
But if you want to make out, then the writer's here. Do you remember a particularly horrible audition that sort of crystallized, like, your frustration with that process?
With that process? Oh, God, so many. I remember doing one particular audition with a very famous actor, which will not remain nameless, and I had to, like, break down and, you know, beg for his forgiveness or something, and he was behind a wall of, like, audition tapes with people's names on them. So I was, like, reading, like, Julia Stiles or, you know, whoever, like, the actors behind him.
Wait, the actual actors that were auditioning for the role?
Like, the tapes, yeah. Like, they had all the tapes. It was very distracting. And I'm, like, meanwhile trying to, like, look at him and be in the moment and seeing all these names. It was bizarre. That was bizarre.
Yeah, you're sitting there, I wonder how Julia Stiles handled this.
Yeah, I know. I was like, what is happening? But no, oh, my God, I've had... And then I had one... A really bad audition once, I remember, with a very well-known director and writer. And in the middle of the scene, again, like a very emotional scene, the writer, there was a lot of people in the room and the writer was over here and he just was like walking around the room, opening potato chips and eating them. Crunching and eating the potato chips and walking around and then leaving the room and then coming back and like, and I'd already waited 2 hours in the waiting room. Some highlights from my career. That was a good one.
It's amazing you're here.
It is amazing.
After a day like that, you'd be like, I'm done with this business.
It's amazing. Yeah, I think auditioning should just be one scene. I don't think it necessarily should have to be like a crazy scene. You know, I think it should be a scene that's accessible. And then if that works, then maybe you get them back. You get come back in again and do something
right.
else.
Right. Well, you talked about feeling some insecurity throughout your career in your own performances. Mm-hmm. And I was curious if you watched this latest film and because maybe it's not a big character like you played in Spy, this over-the-top Russian villain, or you played, you know, in Get Him to the Greek or in Neighbors, you're playing a character. But in Juliet Naked, you're playing a very relatable human being that shares qualities with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm curious if those feelings can still crop up with as much success as you've had.
It's funny. It's like when I first initially see something, like you go to a screening or something like that, it's always, I find that really hard. I don't enjoy it. I don't like going to screens. I don't like watching myself. But if I give it like 5-6 years, then I can watch it and then I'm okay.
Because you're not that person anymore.
Yeah, it's far enough away that I'm like, I can see it and I can go, okay, I can see the whole thing, the whole narrative, what that character is required. I can see the story. When you first watch it, you're just like, I personally don't enjoy it, and I do find it pretty traumatic when I first watch it. I do.
And do you find yourself focusing on odd things that other people probably...
Oh, terrible things. No, I'm always like, well, that's it. That's the last one I've got. I'm never going to get another job. Like, I'm like that. You know,
really?
Very dramatic. Yeah, very, like, dramatic. And
I wonder if that ever goes away.
I know. I don't know. It's so different for everybody, I think, but I definitely still feel like that. I still have, like, tough time watching things and I don't enjoy it. And I always have that, so much so that I for a while didn't go to things and I didn't watch screenings and I didn't because it was just sort of taking me a few steps back and I was like, this isn't like productive. I'm boring myself. I'm boring my partner. I'm boring, you know, everyone around me with my complaining, you know, the Aussie, like, come on, pull your boots up, straps up.
You're actually more annoyed with yourself because you're Australian that you're insecure about.
They're like, exactly. It's like, come on. This is not, in the scheme of the world, this isn't a big problem, but, like, the artistic struggle or pursuit, you know, there's an element of, like, come toughen up. So so I was like, you know what, I'm not going to watch anything because I think I'll just be more pleasant and I can focus on doing a better job when I'm in the room or whatever the other thing may be. But I think as you get older, you know, with that comes sort of less you, I don't know how you found it, but it's not as painful as when you're in your 20s and you're like so desperate to be taken seriously. And so I think the edge is knocked off a little bit. It just has to be. I mean, this business is hard and it's a lot of rejection and you do have to have a thick skin while still remaining open and vulnerable. And I think I've gotten easier on myself, definitely. You know, when you have children and you're tired.
Sure.
You know,
tiredness helps.
You're just so tired.
You don't have enough energy left to
you're so tired.
Worry
you're just
about
like,
how your voice sounds.
Exactly, or I screwed that up, or whatever, yeah.
Well, there is a paradox, I think, to being an actress. You've had 20, 30 years of you know, learning how to thicken your skin enough to handle these horrible auditions.
Sure,
to handle,
rejection and
But also to get really good at dealing with critics or dealing with journalists or dealing with paparazzi or whatever situation. Mm. And then yet you're still supposed to be this human being that can relate emotions to other people.
Yeah, I think that's really challenging. I think that's really hard to like have a thick skin. Like you have to have a thick skin, but then to also remain available emotionally, really vulnerable, accessible to all those, you know, the human condition. I find that a pretty challenging aspect of being an actress.
I would imagine.
Yeah, still do.
It's funny, there's some blooper reel that I came across.
Oh, yeah?
Of all the times that you're breaking in films. Breaking character. And clearly, like, how do you not, when you're across from Seth Rogen or Kristen Wiig or whoever it is, how do you not break character or Melissa McCarthy?
Exactly.
But what I think is, okay, there's these scenes. I'm particularly thinking of in Spy. There's a couple scenes on that reel where you two are on the plane you have to be this close to breaking in those finished takes too.
And it
makes me wonder, like, how thin the veneer is between being in character and losing it.
The whole time. Melissa's so funny, and she's completely unpredictable. You never know what she's going to say. And Spy was ridiculous because I looked so crazy, and I had this hair and the thing, and, like, you know, there was so many times we were just, like, trying to. And I was better. On Bridesmaids, I was terrible. Hot, like, a write-off. Like, they probably lost more than half my footage because I was laughing so much.
Do you ever worry that at some point they're going to come to you and go,
Yes.
We've spent more money on film stock than we paid you to be
I
in
think
this film.
I was, but also I do think there's a small part of the filmmakers that are like, okay, it might be funny. It might be funny if you're laughing.
Right.
But again, with comedy, it's like lightning in a bottle. You never know what's going to work, what's going to make it into the movie, what's going to land, what's not going to make it into the film. It's such a, as I've done more and more, I'm so much more like hands off about it in terms of like, I don't know how the result will be.
Right.
More so than drama in a way. So I just think comedy is such a moving target, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm curious about that switch, okay? Like, I read some director say that he was directing you once and he noticed in the rushes or the dailies that right before he called action, your eyes would almost cross with concentration. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it does. I wonder who that was. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then he said that between takes, she was light and fluffy, and it made me think of a switch that, like, okay, now ready and they're about to call action, and it seems like this switch is flipped. And I'm curious about that, if that is this intrinsic alchemy that just happens, or if you've developed some way mm-hmm. or some superstition or routine that right before action is called, you have a way to go there.
Mm. I don't carry it around as much as I used to. Like, I'm more like in it and then out in it. I liked that sort of immersion. And yeah, I feel like you've put it really well. I feel like it's an alchemy. Like, you just like you suspend everything and you're in it, and then you're not sure what happened, and then it's over.
Right.
If it's going well. I mean, that's a good example. Obviously, there's so many moving parts, but it is a bit like that. That's a really good way to describe it. I feel like it is like sort of an alchemy of everything slightly. You know, you're not quite sure what happened, and then it's over and you're back.
Do you wonder if you thought about it too much or tried to tell someone what you were doing, would you lose it or?
I think so, yeah. For me, I reckon, yeah, I'm a little bit, in that way, a bit superstitious of like too much sort of talking about it. I feel like it's intuition is always the best way to go. Your intuition, your instinct, your intuition, I feel like is the best. With comedy, with drama, I think that's, for me, always been the touchstone for a scene or for all that, is always just following that sort of that thing in you, you know.
Can the insecurity ever threaten to overcome the intuition?
Of course, totally. And each scene requires different things, so you can be counterintuitive about something, or like the director, if you're not having a great relationship with the director and you're bumping heads about things, like that can throw me off and make me uncomfortable. Or if the character's really out there, like in Spy, where the character is so counterintuitive for me, like she's such a different, or the character from Bridesmaids, so they're very polar opposite to my sort of instincts as a person. Like that kind of tension is challenging to find how they would react to a certain situation rather than
how you
Rose.
Would.
Yeah.
Right.
Like Helen from Bridesmaids would be completely different at a wedding than I would be Rose, you know. So finding that kind of that's a tension that can be, but it's also fun, you know. That's what's fun about it. Is
right. You get to be different
part.
People.
Exactly, the fun part. And those parts are so fun because they're like the villain, you know.
Yeah. Is there an example of when, because of circumstances or a director or whatever, you kind of did lose the plot?
Yeah, I feel like early on, when I first started doing the comedic stuff, there's a lot of improv.
Right.
And that is a challenging thing initially because I wasn't sure how that was going to create a character. Do you know what I mean? Like what it was going to do to this character that I was playing and like how they were going to turn out. And actually on a recent job, I was really concerned about what they wanted and what I wanted. And we had to have a few conversations and they were great, really collaborative and everything about it, but we had to have a few chats of like, okay, hold on, I'm seeing it this way. What way are you seeing this? Because I disagree, you know?
Right.
And having to like have a creative conversation about it. And I'm a pretty non-confrontational person, but I was like, wait, my instinct is off here. I'm going one way and you guys want me to go another way, and we need to talk about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into that, because I think that's one of the hardest things probably in an actor's arc of their career path, mm. is going from a point where they are taking any opportunity because they want to work.
Of course, yeah, exactly. You want to work.
To
yeah.
creating opportunities, or to having some control over their path. And I think that you went through that, right? Like, mm. if we back up a little bit and we talk about Damages, mm. you know, that's an interesting show, because on one hand, that was probably the first time that you had a steady job
yeah.
for that long.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
rather than this gypsy film life.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it is like building a brand.
Yeah.
As a character, right?
Totally. I'd mainly done film in Australia and a bit of film over here. And then all of a sudden you're into this show week after week after week with this character. But I grew to love it, because you become so intimate with your character in a way that you know them in a way that you would never know a character if you're doing a film. So I really enjoyed that aspect of being on a television show. I loved that.
Obviously, that show came at a time in your career where it established you, and of course it would be the greatest thing in the world to have
yeah.
steady work.
Oh, gotcha, yeah. yeah.
But did you find when you stepped out of the Damages realm mm. that you had now sort of inadvertently built a brand, or your agents or casting directors or the greater world saw you in a certain way?
They did, absolutely. Yeah, I think that show was so specific, and it was so serious, and it was a great show, but dark and brooding, and
right.
the character was very sort of tortured, and so it definitely did. Yeah, I remember, you know, I had been saying for a long time I'd love to audition for some comedies. Is there any comedies I can audition for? And my agents, they're like, sure, you know, they say whatever you want to hear, but like, they were like, okay. But it took me a while. It took me at least a few years of trying to getting in rooms for comedic stuff before I landed a job. And really, it is hard. I mean, people need to, I guess it's like if you're watching a sportsman, right, that they're a basketball player or a tennis player or a netball player or a volleyball player, and then they're like, you know what, I'm going to be I want to play ice hockey.
Right.
You're like, whoa, just stay in your lane. Stay doing basketball.
So that's an interesting thing.
You should be like going to the ice hockey rink anytime soon, you know.
And that's an interesting distinction, because
yeah.
I think people outside of the industry would not see acting in a drama or acting in a comedy as different as someone who plays basketball and then wants to go play ice hockey. But
yeah, I think it is. I think there's very, very few actors who can go from one to the other without people being a bit like, oh, no, they just do, you know, sort of... Like, I love, like, how Adam Sandler, like, will do, you know, a tiny film with Noah Baumbach, and then he goes and does his big comedies. Like,
right.
that's a great, like, what a interesting thing when people take a risk. But, you know, I'm sure his audience is always surprised if he's... You know, if you see them as one thing and then they, you know, defy your expectations and go to another.
Right. And I would think your agents would be like, wait a minute. Like, we've got a million offers for her to do a Damages-like character, and she can work for years doing this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we have to build this again?
I know. And it's like, it's so much more interesting, no, to be able to do.
Of course.
Something small and dirty and dark and then do a broad thing and, you know, try to mix it up. It's like so much more interesting and scary and fun and all
well,
that kind of stuff.
No one became an actor as a child or dreamed of being an actor so they could play one kind of character.
Exactly.
Over
and over. I know. The idea is to be like different people, you know.
Right.
I'm always in awe of like really sophisticated young girls and how they're so confident with their choices and stuff like that in their 20s. I was definitely not like that. I was much more insecure and more like tortured about stuff. And I think it's now this generation with social media and with all that, so there's like everyone has a clear identity sort of in a different way, for better or worse, I'm not sure. But
right. What you're saying is that there's more access to an understanding of what that lane is,
mm.
although I think the bad side of that is more people are caving into that idea that if they really define themselves super clearly,
yeah.
they can have their audience. And
yes,
maybe that
yeah.
shortchanges the art a little bit.
I think it can. I agree with you. I think it can. But it seems to be like the way it's going, don't you? Like, in a way, I feel like I'm...
You mean in the way we're all becoming robots?
You're not really here, right? This is just a hologram,
no.
a version of you, right?
No, but it brings up a question about what you originally loved about imagination performance. Yeah. And like, I'm curious about that. Yeah. I'm curious if the woman who came off 5 seasons of Damages stopped and said, well, wait a minute, people don't know that I secretly like love comedy and love, you know?
Yeah.
Like, was it a bit of, wait a minute, I don't want to just be defined this way. I want to, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. No, there was a huge desire to do something different. I think in a way, like without that, I wouldn't have done the comedy because it was such an immersive, intense television show. So it was like, oh, what can I do that is completely different? And please let me get into these rooms to audition. Let me, you know.
Right.
And so it was I think one caused the other sort of thing. Like without, you know, I think without that, it probably wouldn't have, you know, sort of maybe not happened. So, and Damages was really respected and we never had a huge audience, but it was like really respected and a lot of filmmakers watched it. And so I got in rooms because of the show,
right.
You know, so that was a huge turning point. I'm so grateful for that. That was, you know, definitely changed my life in many ways.
I saw a audition tape of you for Get 'Em to the Greek, and watching your audition tape, you can feel the room having that total unexpected laughter of, we had no idea. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how you remember that audition, but I got the sense from watching that there was this electricity in the room of oh, we thought she was one thing and
oh, that's cool.
She's so much another.
I'm so pleased you thought that.
Do you remember that?
I do. I remember the audition very clearly because I was, you know, it was a lot of people in the room. There was a lot, you know, it was a long scene. It was a big character. I've really wanted to get, you know, I was so excited to do it, to get in there and audition. And I was nervous and it was, yeah. It was a good audition. I remember feeling like there was a great momentum. And I also thought they were being like quite polite because they were laughing. I was like, oh, that's good. They're being polite. They're sort of like, and it was like surprising me. And I wasn't sure if they were genuinely laughing or, do you know what I mean? Or they were being encouraging laughing.
That's funny.
I was like, are they just like being encouraging or are they really laughing?
Were they eating chips?
No one was, thank God. Nobody was like eating chips, walking around, leaving the room and coming back out. And I didn't have to wait too long. But it definitely was one of the better auditions, you know.
And did you sort of have a plan like, okay, I'm going to actively change people's perceptions and go after these films and have a little fun? And like, was that sort of the plan?
As much as you can have a plan in this business, it's
right.
So, it's such not a plan business. You know what I mean? It's so sort of what comes your way, what doesn't come your way. What, like, it's such a arbitrary kind of mess, and you can plan as much as you want and dream as much as you want, but it's also completely out of your control, you know,
right.
If you're not the producer or the director or whatever it is. And so I did in as much as like really wanting to break out from the Damages role, do something different. I love comedies. I'm Australian. We have a good sense of humor, you know, like, but it's funny working now on comedy. It's such a, just because you're a funny person doesn't mean you're a funny actor. And just because you're a funny actor doesn't mean you're a funny person. Like, it's very, those things don't correlate at all, which
right.
People usually think they do. Well, I did, and they don't. It's like a very separate thing, very separate.
Well, it makes me wonder if you had those same misconceptions when you stepped onto a set like Bridesmaids and you've got Kristen Wiig and you've got Maya Rudolph. You got all these, like, titans of female comedy. Melissa McCarthy. Did you feel intimidated, or did you feel like, you know, that feeling of imposter, they're going to find out type
of
thing?
I did, yeah, I was. I was really nervous on that set. I was also, it was so exciting to be able to work with all those women. It was, like, so fun, the days when we were all there together. And I was I am a huge Kristen Wiig fan. Like, I just think she's so brilliant and she's an icon, you know, she's amazing. And even from the first time I auditioned, I was like, wow, like meeting someone that you have such great respect for and such admiration for, it was really wild. And then to be on the movie, I mean, I was just so excited. I was so excited. I was like,
how does that live with the insecurity? Like, at what point did the insecurity peak in terms of like, oh, now I have to go do the job, even though I'm excited to work with her, but...
I remember doing some read-throughs early on and rehearsals, and that I was nervous. I was definitely nervous. I think it took me a while to probably relax and be more confident and trust that Paul had cast me for the right reasons and that it was going to, you know, it was all going to come together, because I definitely was intimidated initially because, you know, Ellie, Wendy, Maya, Melissa, they all were from from either UCB or Groundlings background. Like, they've all done a lot of that improv comedy.
And when you don't have that background, you assume they learned some secret sauce, right?
Of course. They do, in a way. I mean, that's just training, no? It's like just training of that. And I had done that. So I definitely was a little bit of the fish out of water. But it probably worked with the character. She was kind of a fish out of water. She was sort of the one who, you know, she was definitely the imposter in a way. Like, she was this kind of the villainous character who was, like, blowing everything up for Annie and destroying her, like, plan and everything. So
yeah.
So I'm sure it helped. In a way, it was a little bit parallel to Helen herself.
I would assume that the first thing to go when you lose a little confidence is your ability to think on your feet and be an active listener, which is exactly what improv requires.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I'm good in that. There's also an element, I think, of when you're on set and you're doing it and you're in the costumes and the hair and everything and everyone's there and there's a whole thing around you making this happen and you really rise to the occasion. And I think that's something you always have to trust as an actor, is that you will rise to the occasion and something will take care of you. And it's a little ephemeral and it's a bit, you know, but it will. It's like when you're doing a play and you're sick. And there's this thing of, like, Dr. Theater will come, you know, and she does. She comes, and you get through the play, and then you finish the play, and you go home, you go to bed, and you take Advil, and you blow your nose, and then you go back and you do it again. It's funny. It's like you just rise to the occasion, and I think that I do trust that usually
does happen. It must be unnerving to need that to show up. Like, at what point does Dr. Theater show up, or what point does, like, that inspiration
come? Dr. Theater
leave,
yeah. I just see does. She shows up, she gives you the adrenaline, she gets you on stage, and you get through it and you forget. And it's like we're saying in the take, it's that thing of, like, you're not sure how what happened, you're not sure what happened, but then you get out the other side and it's like, oh, okay, I did it.
How do you improv when you're not doing your own accent?
Well, with practice, it's gotten better. I think that's part of the reason in Neighbours, Seth and Stola were like, we want you to just be yourself and, you know, we want you to bring that quality to the character. And that sort of worked too, because she became like this rowdy kind of Aussie, you know, like rambunctious character. But I enjoy it. I love all those sort of little fun. For me, that's also like fun. I love like the accents and all that sort of character stuff is great fun. I love that. And it's challenging improvising with an accent, but I enjoy it. I enjoy all that so much.
But when you were doing that and you're asked to improv and you're playing and, like, is there an extra layer of I have to remember to, like, how
yes
do you just react in the moment
and
still keep an accent?
And still, yes and no. Occasionally I have to check myself, but I'm usually pretty confident with the accent. I am confident. That's one thing I will say. I do have confidence with an accent. I'm okay. But it definitely takes, like, a bit of, you definitely have to warm up and you've got to be, like, you know, and I'm my worst critic too. If I hear it, I'm like, I can hear that. Let me do it again. And I'm, you know.
So do you ask for takes when you're like,
oh, yeah,
the Australian
totally. Yeah, I'll be like, can I do that?
I
can hear it. Yeah, absolutely.
And if you watched it now, would you find moments where?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I could, yep, totally. I'm like, and also with other people's performance. If there's like a British person playing something or
you'll catch
this, I'm like, I can hear it.
As a kid, were you a mimic?
Yeah, I like to. I mean, being the youngest of four children, I was sort of like that classic younger child, and I definitely did, I'm sort of more of an observer, that thing of you were saying, of like observing things and then, you know, mimicking them later.
Yeah.
Mimicking them later.
Yeah.
Some, I'm better, yeah.
Because I would assume that in Australia you'd watch a good portion of English television and American television. So I guess you were exposed to accents early.
Absolutely. It's very familiar, both those accents. Australia is such a melting pot of, you know, influence of culture, obviously from England and from Ireland and all the different, you know, there's incredibly different, diverse culture in Australia. But we do have a lot of American television, so you are so familiar with the sound growing up. It's such a familiar, you know, noise. And it's like, so that, I think, really informs why Aussies are very easy with the accent, because I think we've just had it from a really young age.
What would you all watch together as a family?
Fawlty Towers.
Fawlty Towers?
Yeah.
John Cleese?
Yeah.
I loved that show.
Yeah. Yeah, so did I. That was like, I was very strict. I was really strict with television, my parents, but that was the one show we could all watch and we
that
would
was all
laugh
okay.
and we all loved, and that was like the kind of, that was the hands down, the show.
Do you think any of that rubbed off? Like, as a kid, how did you find out that you loved being on stage and loved, like, were you the kid that was always outgoing? And
I was more the shy kid. I was the I was the shy, funny. It's like sort of the one or the other. The actors who want to be seen, I think, and the actors who want to be hiding. You know, I feel like there's two types a little bit, and I was more like the one who wanted to disappear, I think. And I just loved it. I loved performing, and I loved, you know. When I first started acting classes, I was really little, I was only 8, and I just loved it. But day to day, I was really shy. I was very shy, quiet, sort of, you know.
That distinction of wanting to hide.
Or wanting to be seen,
and
yeah.
A character wanting to be seen, because...
That's just a theory. I don't know. Does that resonate with you? Do you feel like that's going to make sense?
It does. The distinction you're making is that you can be shy, but still love performing.
I think so. I think... It's because you're not, like, for instance, I'm terrible at public speaking. I'm not good at public speaking.
What happens when you think about public speaking?
I'm inarticulate. I'm not funny. I'm not confident. I have not, but when I'm performing or on stage or doing a play or doing a job on TV or whatever, I don't have that fear, that, like, paralyzing fear that I have if I have to go on and do, like, accept an award or give an award or do anything like that. Like, that's really, like, I really have to, like, okay, I've got to, like, step up, and it does not come naturally to me at all.
What do you think that is?
I don't know. I'm like...
Is it being seen without any veneer of a character?
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt, it's like, I don't have a script, I don't have a character, I don't have the costume, and I don't have the whole thing going on that is, like, licensing me to do this role and the narrative of the story and all this whole thing that's being set up. It's just this, I have no confidence with it at all. I just crumble. You know what's the number one fear in America is public speaking?
I've heard that.
You know that great Seinfeld joke?
Tell me.
If you're at the funeral, you'd rather be in the casket than giving the eulogy. But that's literally the number one fear, which I find crazy in America, because I feel like in America, like, 1 in 3 people could have their own talk show.
Right.
This is the culture of,
well,
like,
clearly they'll give
conversation.
One to anybody.
You know, it's the culture of conversation, which is what I love about America. Like, it's like therapy, and it's like culture of that, which is great. So different to Australia, which is like, repressed English much more,
right.
You know, toughen up. But so for me, I definitely fall in that category of, like, I really crumble in those situations. I'm not good. I so admire those actresses or actors who get up and be so eloquent and articulate and give awards and make jokes and this person and that, but I'm just like, so bad at it.
You wonder, though, if they're also feeling that inside and
but who cares if they are? They're doing a great job. It's like, well, whatever. You may be dying inside, but you look really confident. I can't even manifest that part of it. Just like,
when I hear that, it makes me think what a massive love it must be for the craft of what you do, because by taking on this career, you put yourself in a lot of those situations. And I don't just mean public speaking. I mean, you know, you are this known person, and going out in public life, you're going to attract attention that can't be all that different from public speaking. It's just,
oh, sure, that kind of,
you know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Sure, that sort of aspect of it.
Look,
I've had minimal in terms of, like, attention and paparazzi and those sorts of things. Like, it's very, you know, each person's career is very different, how it evolves. And I've been on the easier end of that stuff. Like, I've had friends who've really suffered from, like, incredible stress with, their lives being under scrutiny and all those sorts of things, and how it takes its toll and on relationships and all those sorts of things. And I've been really relatively lucky with all of that sort of stuff. But it's and I think it's also, yeah, I feel like I've been lucky with that, and probably in a good way, because I do find that stuff, it does fall under the category of a little bit of that public speaking thing, of being under that public scrutiny, which I would find it's not why I'm doing it, you know. I'm doing it because I love acting, and I loved being in a story, and I love collaborating, I love artists and actors, you know, I love the business, I love the work, so.
I think that's an interesting distinction, is that not everybody that goes into this wants attention. They love the craft, and it just turns out that the craft,
you want
is,
the attention for the right reason, you know, like, you want the attention so then you can get the great job with the great director that you really want, you know. You don't necessarily want the attention, but it's not, yeah, it's not like, it's not why I'm And I think you see that with my, I've always been under the radar in a way. So,
yeah. Well, you like it there.
Well, I'm here today. I'm here today.
And now that I know all this, I am very impressed you came.
No, it's, but that scrutiny would be tough. And I have seen friends who've gone through it, and it's like, it's, whether it's invited or not, it's just like an added, it's pretty stressful. I think it would be pretty stressful.
I think so. I think it really is.
Yeah.
And I think that the roles you've managed to choose and the people you've managed to work with, it's been a pretty impressive, like you could look at your career and say, she's had a great plan, although I'm sure it doesn't feel that way. but to, you know, to be on Damages with such a mentor as Glenn Close,
and to
fall in with Paul Feig.
And Judd, and been really lucky.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that too, because I read something about you and Seth Rogen, and one of your concerns on Neighbors being that you didn't want the wife character to turn into what wife characters often turn into on male gaze comedies, which is the voice of reason that
the buzzkill.
The buzzkill.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think there's some of that in Old School.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think it's inherent in some of the stereotypes that have worked in comedies.
Yeah.
But a very interesting thing I read was that apparently you were talking to Seth Rogen and he said, why don't we switch dialogue?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And this blew my mind that this false idea that there's some dividing line between this is how women talk and this is how men talk.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me curious about if that was sort of a great step forward in your career to be able to look at that and have the ability and have an open co-star that says, well, let's look at that and see if that's true. It's almost like an experiment, right?
It was. And that was, I mean, they said that really early on too. Nick Stoller was really like, the whole idea is they have a great marriage. It's a partnership. She's not a nag. She's as irresponsible as he is. They're this like destructive kind of dysfunctional parenting team, but they're great. They're a great couple, even though they sort of party too much, you know?
Right, right.
Creatively, that was brilliant. I just loved that. And Seth was, always open to like switching dialogue or like, Him being the butt of being the nagging joke or, trying to reverse it the whole time. I think that's one of the reasons why Neighbours is different, because it does break that sort of traditional nagging wife buzzkill role and one of the reasons I really wanted to do it and why Nick was, like, determined to change that stock character from something else. So I think it worked. I think in the end it was like, it was sort of, they come across as like this ridiculously irresponsible couple together.
It makes me curious about throughout your career when you've gotten scripts, if you've ever looked across the gender and gone, I want that part, or why is my character not written that way, or why?
More and more. I think when I started out, I was so hungry to work and so hungry to like, and I had also done a bit of theatre back in Australia and always traditionally, the roles in the theatre, it's better writing for women, so I had been lucky to sort of do sort of little plays and stuff where the roles were just as good for the woman as it was for the guy.
Right.
And then, you're starting out and you go, all those cliches we're talking about, like, my top's off in scene three, I'm crying in all of these audition scenes, I've got 75 pages to learn and all those sorts of things. But it's a grind, but you sort of like, how do you break the system when you're starting out? It was sort of like later when I finally started to get, reading Damages, going, wow, this is a great, and like those guys, KZK, had been like, how do we get like a character like Tony Soprano, but what if it was a woman?
How many television shows exist where there's two female protagonists?
Mm-hmm.
The men are like just supporting characters.
Yeah.
Like, it was pretty rare.
It really was. Even then, looking back, I go, wow, like, I was spoiled. I was spoiled with that material. And at the time, I totally did realize that. I was like, this is an unusual premise. This is really a unique thing. And it is written by men, but it's like, wow, this is a really unique and unusual premise that they're purposefully trying to flip these roles around. And who better than Glenn Close to bring that gravitas and that kind of, respect. She's such a heavyweight.
Do you think that conditioned you to look for?
I was spoiled.
Just naturally,
absolutely spoiled. I did get spoiled with that having this great material every week, a great episode, great arc working with Glenn, you know, this, it didn't feel like a TV show in that sense of like TV being, I mean, now there's no difference, it's so great, but it didn't then. The writing was so good, and having Glenn Close as your scene partner was like, my God, this is better than everything I've done yet. You know, I'm so lucky.
But should that be called spoiled?
I know. Well, that's the thing. It shouldn't be. That should just be the standard. And it's getting like that. I mean, look at now. Look at Handmaid's Tale. Look at Big Little Lies. Look at these fantastic, you know. I think there is changing, and I just hope more and more. I hope that the people in power are still held accountable, because they're the ones who are really, you know, get to sign off on everything, you know. And the shift is happening. Like, everyone's spoken. It's out. Like, there's a chorus about it. It's everything's slowly becoming more exposed and all these sorts of things. So it's just about keeping the momentum up and keeping... having people held accountable and having people who are in positions of power, like, changing because, you know, they have to, you know, because the people have, like, spoken. And
but what we're talking about is the way that we present role models and humanity in the most powerful ways as storytellers to people.
Sure, like how we're represented, no?
So it's how, like, women are represented.
How women are represented. And traditionally you watch these things and you're like, I don't know any woman like that, or, I, you know, these, and it's just true. I mean, the perspective of, you know, one person is going to be completely different to another, and it's been one perspective for a long time, no? Of, like, usually a guy, usually a white guy, usually of a certain age, who's been in charge of all this stuff, and it's their perspective, and instead it's like, hey, how about some fresh perspectives, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's happening, because then you get better representation, no? Of, like, what, you know, of women, you go, oh, I recognise that person, I know that person, I'm that person, you know. That's much more interesting. And I think viewers have asked for that too.
You know, it's funny, when you think about your career span and how long and how far you've come from, I don't know, sitting in a trailer for weeks waiting on the set of Troy. Or, you know, just how far and how much your career has paralleled an industry shift. You know, is it interesting to look back at where the industry was when you started? And not just that you now have the more power to change things, but it's a funny time how much things have shifted just in your
my
span
lifetime,
of your short career.
Absolutely. Relatively. And it's an important thing to do. I remember a friend of mine saying that to me recently, like when you're getting frustrated or you miss out on a part, or you're like, and he was like, you have to look back and look how far you've come. You have to, because it's the only way you can sort of give yourself a break and be like, look how far I've come from that, person who was like, you know, starting out and getting, you know, not confident, smaller roles and wanting to do lots of things and not having done them yet. And you've got to go look back and see how far you've come. Like, and that's really important. And you forget to do that in this day and age, no? Because you're just like, the next.
Everything's forward
everything's forward.
Bombarding
it's like
us.
Everyone's got, like, you know, no attention span, and it's like, so... it's important to really try to do that, to just look back and go, hell, you know what? I have, like, you know, it's like, be okay with it, you know, look back. And that totally reflects also, to your point, the change in the business. Like, wow, like what it started as to now what it is, and how, like, the behaviours I've seen on sets with directors, whether they be, you know, for whatever reason, how that wouldn't be tolerated now. Or that would be really, like, a risky thing to do for these people to work with these people who I've seen, their behaviour and what they get away with. And you go, that's not going to be tolerated anymore, you know, from 15 years ago when I started out in the business, you know.
Yeah.
So it's definitely interesting.
I think that's such a great way to calm yourself when you're worried about the future is just go, wait a minute, look how far
you've come.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you know, just like give yourself a break for 5 minutes if you didn't achieve the one thing you wanted to achieve. Because you definitely have to have drive in this business and ambition and all those sorts of things. Like, you don't just, for as much as like, you know, being artistic and everything, you definitely have to have that, a drive of some sort.
Yeah.
For sure, wherever it may come from. Mm.
Well, listen, I have enjoyed talking to you so much.
Thanks, Sam. I feel like I've just been blabbing at you.
No, that's what happens on this show.
I hope you can edit it into something vaguely interesting.
No, it's been wonderful. And thank you for, you know, thank you for trying to dig into the ephemeral process a little bit, which is hard to talk about.
Yeah, it is such
But it's fascinating.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, good. No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Hey folks, that's our show with Rose. I really enjoyed that. And if you want to see Rose on the big screen, go see Juliet Naked. My personal recommendation would be to read Nick Hornby's book and watch the film adaptation. That would be going deep, as we like to say around here. Also check Rose out in Spy, Neighbors, Damages, and basically everything else she's been in. And after you do that, make sure to visit offcamera.com and see what we are all about. If you haven't checked out the TV show, you're in for a whole world of black and white fun. Over 150 episodes archived for your binging pleasure. And if you want to follow us on social media, we are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And hey, don't keep your opinions to yourself. We want to share the good word of this show, and we'd also like to hear about who you think would be great on Off Camera. So share your opinions on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. Let people know you love the show. Let me know who you want to see on the show, and we can all be better for it. You can also reach me via email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. I love hearing from you and finding out about your creative pursuits. I also wish someone would send me a good recipe for bolognese sauce. Mine's pretty good, but it could be improved. And most importantly, be sure to join us next week when I sit down with actor, writer, and producer Chris O'Dowd.
I love the job. The business part of it, the industry part of it, can be so stupid and mind-numbing. You know, the movies are the fucking magic. Like, that's why we're all here. And the idea of being storytellers and giving something to the public, we gotta aim high. Even if it's escapism, it doesn't necessarily need to be intellectual, but it has to, you gotta aim high. And when we don't do that, when we don't take on that responsibility and just make garbage, that's on us.
I fell in love with some of Chris's earlier work on Moon Boy, The IT Crowd, and his lovable cop persona in Bridesmaids. And I thought I had him pegged until I saw Get Shorty, the noir meets Hollywood TV series that he stars in with Ray Romano. He plays a cold-blooded, murdering manipulator so well that I started getting a little nervous about having him on the show. That either tells you how good he is or how gullible and impressionable I am. I prefer to believe it is the former. Well, it turns out I had little to worry about. Chris is a lovely guy who likes to dress like me and felt a little bit like my long-lost brother, to tell you the truth. And I loved our conversation about lowering expectations, discovering your calling later in life, and, well, underwear preferences. See you next time, off camera.